Tantor Audio presents Runner by William C. Dietz. Narrated by Sean Renette. 1. The Planet Anafa. Once accepted, a contract to deliver a message, package, or person will be honored regardless of cost. The Runner's Oath. The sun filtered through the charcoal-generated haze that hung over Syros, warmed the city's ancient bones, and hinted at the coming of summer. A great deal had changed during the more than 10,000 years since the first colony ship had landed on Anafa. A raw settlement had grown into a village, a town, and eventually a city. Not one city, but multiple cities, all stacked on top of each other like layers of ancient sediment. As Jack Rebo made his way through the streets, he could see the remains of the last techno-civilization in the straight grid-like streets and the weather-worn pylons that marched down the middle of the main arterials. Each column was topped by a hoop of gleaming steel through which bullet-shaped vehicles had once flown, or so it appeared based on the huge floor mosaic in what presently served as the city's public market. Some of the structures that rose to the left and right dated back to that same time, an era when power was plentiful. Lift tubes carried people to the top of high-rise buildings that stood as thick as trees in a forest. But the skyscrapers were little more than empty cadavers now, hulks from which everything of value had been stripped, leaving rusty skeletons to point impotently at the sky. Most of the structures that lined the streets were no more than 5 stories tall, because that represented how many flights of stairs the average person was willing to climb. As buildings burned or were torn down, new ones were built according to the tastes of those who could afford to do so. That activity, carried out over thousands of years, had resulted in a diversity of architecture. Some buildings had been hung with balconies, topped with domes, or provided with columns that they didn't need. The older structures all had one thing in common, however, and that was the rectangular boxes from which street numbers had been removed in order to create a need for the hand-drawn maps that the Writers Guild sold to people like Rebo. Many of the frames had been painted or filled with tiles, but some remained as they had been, wounds over which no scab had been allowed to form. Though understandable to some extent, the Runner was annoyed by what he and his guild considered to be a desecration of the city's past and the destruction of a system by which written messages had once been delivered on a daily basis, an unheard-of luxury since the Great Purge 128 years before, when thousands of technocrats had been rounded up and slaughtered in the main square. Rebo took a look around before stepping into the shadow cast by an ancient arch to examine his hand-drawn schematic without attracting unwanted attention. Though useful, maps could be dangerous, since strangers were the only ones who used them. Unlike some members of his guild, who dressed like dandies in hopes of attracting wealthy clients, the Runner preferred to wear everyday clothes. A bandana covered his jet-black hair, a gold earring dangled from one ear, and he hadn't shaved in 2 days. The Crosser 10mm semi-auto pistol hung butt down under his left arm, hidden by the Runner's red leather jacket. But the single-shot hogger with the 14-inch barrel was intentionally visible. It rode in a cross-draw holster along the front of his belly and was powerful enough to stop a 300-pound heavy. Rebo's trousers were black, baggy, and gathered around a pair of worn lace-up boots. All in all, the sort of outfit that thousands of the planet's middle-class citizens sported every day. Because of that, and the fact that there was nothing inherently threatening about the man who stood by the arch, the locals ignored the Runner as they set out for the local bakery, hawked their wares, or made their way into one of the local taverns. Satisfied that no one was following him or otherwise monitoring his movements, Rebo consulted the map. He was looking for merchant Marley Telvas, a wealthy businessman who was said to live in the Reservoir District. Now, having passed the man-made lake from which the area took its name, the Runner was on the lookout for landmarks that would help him identify the correct dwelling. He spotted the top of a small spire, figured it was the same 50-foot-tall obelisk that appeared on his map, and started in that direction. As the runner drew closer, a vine-covered 12-foot-high wall appeared on his right, a sure sign that someone had something worth stealing. It turned out that the spire was firmly planted on an island located in the middle of the street just opposite a pair of well-varnished wooden gates. The city's police force, or guard, as it was commonly known, was notoriously understaffed, incompetent, and corrupt. That meant that everyone who could afford to do so paid members of the Watchkeepers Guild for extra protection, be it heavily armed norms like those who lounged in front of the gates directly across from Rebo, or the cudgel-toting heavies who patrolled the better neighborhoods during the night. The runner looked both ways before crossing the street. While none of the brightly uniformed watchmen looked to be especially bright, one of them proved to be fairly assertive. His voice was gruff.
"I don't know what you're selling, citizen, but it's safe to say that Merchant Telvas already has one of them."
Rebo could be charming when he chose to be. He summoned his best smile and displayed the lightning bolt that had been tattooed onto the inside surface of his left forearm when he was 12. "I'm a runner. Is Merchant Telvas home?"
"What difference does it make?" the watchman demanded. "Give me the message and I will deliver it for you."
Rebo shook his head, saw that the other watchmen were moving to flank him, and took 3 steps back. He hooked his right thumb into the gun belt only inches from the hogger, and the effort to surround him stopped. "Thanks," the runner said evenly, "but I am required to put the message into his hands. That's what it says in the guild book, and that's what I have to do." The head watchman wasn't surprised. Even though the runner had already been paid by the person who had sent the message, he wanted to deliver it personally in hopes of a generous tip. A perfectly understandable motivation, but one that he planned to quash. If anyone was to receive a tip, the guard believed that it should be him.
"Okay," the watchman growled, "but no weapons. They stay with us."
It was a ticklish moment. The request was reasonable, since members of the Assassin's Guild had been known to impersonate runners, even going so far as to have fake guild marks tattooed onto their skins. But once Rebo surrendered his weapons, he would be at the watchman's mercy. Would they allow him to pass? Or take the box and deliver it themselves? Or worse yet, take the box, keep his weapons, and send him packing? He could summon the guard, but ultimately it would be his word against theirs. Time seemed to stretch thin, and Rebo was about to back away when Yuba, the goddess of luck, came to his rescue. There was a loud clatter as a bell rang. A small Anjen-drawn cart rounded a corner, and the driver shouted at a pedestrian foolish enough to cross the street in front of it. The conveyance was little more than a box on wheels, but still managed to convey a sense of importance via its well-oiled leather roof, pristine paint job, and the enormous brass lanterns mounted to either side of the brightly clad driver. The genetically engineered animal that stood between the traces still bore a strong resemblance to the horses from which it was descended, except that the engine was stronger, faster, and even more graceful. A man leaned out of a window as the cart ground to a halt. He had a full face, sensual lips, and wore a bright yellow turban decorated with a white feather.
"What's going on here? Open the gate!"
The man could have been a visitor, but Rebo didn't think so, and took a chance.
"Citizen Telvas, my name is Jack Rebo. I have a package from your brother."
The watchman moved to intervene, but the merchant raised a pudgy hand.
"From my brother? Surely you're mistaken."
"He said that you might doubt his identity," Rebo replied quickly, "and told me to tell you that he was the one who took your rock collection when you were 6, and that he's sorry." The merchant's eyes widened as if he was surprised, and he hooked a thumb toward the back of the carriage.
"Jump aboard."
Rebo took a dozen steps forward, jumped up onto the step where a footman could ride, and grabbed onto the sidebars. The gate had been opened by then, and the watchmen glowered as the cart jerked into motion. Rebo offered them an insulting gesture and grinned as their faces turned purple and the gate swung closed.
Though not especially large, the grounds were well kept and lavishly decorated. As the cart made its way up a slight incline to a formal entry, the runner saw all manner of statues, seats, and fountains to either side of the drive. Too many, in his judgment, as if someone continued to purchase objects long after the need to do so had passed. The cart came to a halt under a portico. Servants rushed out to welcome their master home, and Talvas had just stepped onto a carefully placed footstool as the runner rounded the corner of the carriage. The merchant nodded. "Fiva will show you to my study. I'll be along soon." Rebo had no desire to linger, but discovered that he didn't have a whole lot of choice as Talvas turned and entered his house. The structure was 3 stories tall, capped by domes of varying heights and painted an eye-searing white. Fiva proved to be a young, rather comely servant girl with waist-length hair and a floral dress. Very few strangers were allowed within the walls, so she was understandably curious about the ruffian her master had brought home, and directed sidelong glances at the runner as she escorted him into the house. It was cool inside, and thanks to a generous supply of windows, very well lit. The ceilings were high, the rooms were generously proportioned, and the same excess that could be seen outside was visible within. Not only was each room they passed through full to overflowing with furniture, but it seemed as though every surface supported a lamp, urn, or vase, many of which struck the runner as quite hideous. The smell of freshly baked bread filled the air. The tinkle of a distant bell floated through the lightly perfumed air, and Rebo wondered if Madame Talvas had just rung for her maid. Fiva led the runner around a corner, gestured toward a long, roughly hewn bench, and curtsied. "Please wait here. Master Talvas will be along soon." Others were waiting for an audience as well. One had the sleek, well-fed look of a professional, an accountant, judging from the well-worn abacus that rested beside him, while the other wore work clothes and sat with his feet on a well-crafted wooden toolbox. A carpenter, perhaps, hoping to receive a commission or having been summoned to repair something of substance. Rebo nodded to both men, took note of their somewhat grim expressions, and decided that both had been there for a while. Time passed. Shadows slipped across the opposite wall, and the carpenter started to snore. The runner didn't own a watch, not since a well-endowed barmaid had stolen it 3 months earlier, but didn't need one to know that at least 2 hours had passed by the time the door finally opened and Talvas stepped into the hall. The turban had disappeared, along with the robes, leaving the merchant in a loose-fitting white shirt, baggy black pants, and house slippers. It was a deceptively simple outfit that probably cost a chrono, if not more. The accountant started to rise, clearly expecting that he would go first, but the merchant pointed to Rebo. "You, come in." Rebo rose, followed by Talvas into his study, and pulled the door closed behind him. The merchant circled an enormous wooden desk to sit in a throne-like chair positioned behind it. There were 2 guest chairs, and Rebo decided to appropriate one of them without benefit of an invitation. Unlike the rest of the house, the study was nearly barren, suggesting that it was someone other than Talvas who enjoyed the process of buying things just to buy them. That observation served to elevate the merchant in the runner's estimation. "So," Talvas began, "you have a message for me?" "No," Rebo replied, as he reached inside his jacket. "Not a message, but a package." Talvas watched the runner produce a flat box and place it on the surface of his highly polished desk. It was wrapped in blue cloth, tied with a red ribbon, and looked a bit worn. Strangely, from Rebo's point of view, the merchant made no attempt to touch it. Their eyes met. "What does the package contain?" Rebo shrugged. "I don't know. Your brother didn't say." "Tell me more about my brother," Talvas said, leaning back into his chair. "What does he look like?" It was a common question, one that runners, especially interstellar runners, received all the time. Communications between star systems were infrequent at best, which meant that those who were fortunate enough to receive a letter or package often requested a description of their friends or loved ones. Usually, after opening whatever they had received, however. "Your brother looks a lot like you," Rebo answered honestly, "although he has more gray in his hair. He was nicely dressed, much as you are, and wore a lot of gold jewelry." "Was there anything else?" Talvas demanded. "Anything unusual about his body or the way that he moved?" Rebo thought back to the meeting that had taken place more than 2 years before. Unlike the present encounter, it had been brief. But there had been something distinctive about the other brother's movements. "Yes, your brother had a pronounced limp." "Ah," Talvas replied thoughtfully, "so he still has the leg. I know this conversation must seem strange to you, but suffice it to say that my brother and I had what you might call a business disagreement, which culminated in an injury to his leg. I had assumed that the medicos would remove it." "So tell me, Citizen Rebo," the merchant said, forming a steeple with his fingers. "What was your impression of my brother?" "I haven't seen him in many years. Is he a nice man?" Rebo summoned up a picture of a man with hard eyes, slightly overripe lips, and freshly powdered skin. A man who looked like he'd been a killer once, but currently considered himself to be above that sort of thing, and hoped to leave the previous life behind. But did it make sense to say that? No, the runner thought to himself, and was about to lie when Talvas produced 3 gold chronos and pushed them across the desk. It was a gratuity, and a generous one, which would make a nice addition to the account that Rebo maintained with the Runner's Guild. "Take them," the merchant ordered, "and put them in your pocket. Then give me your answer, and not the one you think I want to hear." Rebo slid the coins off into a palm, felt their reassuring weight, and stashed them in one of the many pockets that lined the inside of his jacket. With that accomplished, the runner looked straight into the other man's eyes. "I think your brother is an extremely dangerous man." The merchant nodded soberly. "So, that being the case, would you open the box?" Rebo looked down at the seemingly innocent box and back up again. "No, sir, I wouldn't." "But what if it contains a peace offering?" the other man insisted. "What then?" "I feel bad about what happened to my brother's leg and would like to make it up to him." The runner shrugged. "Your brother didn't strike me as a man who makes peace offerings. But the choice is yours." "Yes, I suppose it is," Talvas replied. "Thank you for delivering the box, and thank you for the advice. Fiva will show you to the gate." Rebo stood. "Is there a rear entrance?" Talvas nodded understandingly. "Yes, there is. Tell Fiva, and she will take you there." Rebo withdrew after that, discovered that Fiva had appeared in the hall, and glanced back over his shoulder as she closed the door. The box remained on the surface of the desk, and Talvas continued to stare at it. The runner slipped out through the back gate 10 minutes later, was pleased when none of the watchmen stationed there showed the least bit of interest in him, and started down the street. Rebo had walked about 100 feet and was just about to cross a street when he heard a dull thump and looked back in time to see a puff of smoke shoot out of a window. The study? Yes, he thought so. There were cries of alarm, followed by hysterical screams, and Rebo knew that Talvas was dead. The runner paused to take a slow look around. Was there another runner lurking in the area? A man or woman hired to confirm the merchant's death and carry a message back to his brother. There wasn't any sign of one, but that didn't mean much, so Rebo sauntered away. It was a nice day, a profitable day, but one that left him with an unfathomable question. How could such an apparently smart man be so stupid? Even though Lanny Noor was a stranger to the city, the marketplace was easy to find. First, because at least half of the traffic flowing into Saros was headed there, and second, because once the sensitive drew close enough, she could smell the rich amalgam of spices, fried food, and Angen feces that scented the air around it. Then, as she entered the market, even more senses came into play. There were racks of colorful fabrics, bins filled with vegetables, tables covered with jewelry, booths hung with amulets, racks of handmade clothing, piles of woven baskets, bags filled with white nuts, reels of hand-twisted rope, trays loaded with fragrant candles, display boards covered with wicked-looking knives, and so much more that one couldn't hope to see all of it in a single day. And there were sounds, too. The rumble of a thousand haggling voices was punctuated by the squawks, snorts, and squeals of caged engines, the incessant shouts of vendors who never stopped hawking their wares, the ring of hammers on metal, the wail of a lost child, and occasional snatches of music. But there was more. Much more, for Nora at least, who, unlike 99% of the people swirling about her, could see the separate energy fields that each individual emitted, catch glimpses of the discarnate spirits who flitted through the area intent on errands of their own, and was constantly buffeted by waves of projected emotion. Not because she sought to experience such things, but because her ancestors had been genetically engineered to pick up on other people's emotions, manipulate small objects from a distance, heal the sick, and communicate with the dead. As Nora made her way through the market, she was exposed to continual bursts of love, hate, greed, fear, lust, and happiness, as those about her wrestled with what fellow sensitives referred to as the Holy Trinity: money, sex, and power. The basic drives behind most human activity, including hers. Because it took money to survive, which was why the sensitive had been forced to emerge from hiding and make the long, uncomfortable trek into Saros. So, unpleasant though the task was, Nor wandered the long, tight aisles until she spotted the sign she'd been looking for. Most of the city's population were functionally illiterate, so a large replica of a quill had been hung over the booth, and therefore over the scribe who sat on a stool beneath it. Like most of his ilk, the bespectacled clerk was a member of the so-called A-strain, meaning the 80% of humans also referred to as norms. Most had black hair, olive-colored skin, and long, slender bodies. There were exceptions, of course, genetic throwbacks to the days hundreds of thousands of years before, when people came in a rainbow of colors. Such individuals were rare, however. This specimen sported a bowl cut, a pair of thick, hand-ground lenses that were perched on the very tip of his nose, and radiated smug superiority. His aura flickered and morphed into something like apprehension as Nora approached the counter, because even though the young woman with the pack, the long wooden staff, and the knee-high boots looked innocent enough, she had the large, dark eyes, high cheekbones, and narrow face of a sensitive, a breed that the scribe, like many others, had reason to fear. Not because of a personal experience with one, but because they were said to read minds, and the wordsmith had things to hide. Like his tendency to mentally undress almost every woman he encountered. In fact, he had already stripped Nor, noting that her breasts were too small for his tastes when she arrived in front of his counter. The clerk swallowed the lump that had threatened to fill his throat and struggled to speak.
"Yes?"
he croaked.
"Can I help you?"
Nor couldn't read minds, but she could sense the emotions that surrounded the man and was willing to take advantage of them. "You're a very naughty man," she said experimentally, and knew she had scored when the scribe's face turned bright red.
I'm sorry," the wordsmith stuttered. "I didn't mean anything by it."
"Good," Nor replied soothingly. "Apology accepted. Perhaps you can help me."
"I'll certainly try,"
the clerk replied eagerly, pleased to get off the hook so easily.
"What do you need, a letter perhaps?"
"No," Nor replied deliberately. "I could write that myself. What I need is some advertising."
"Ah," the scribe responded happily, "a flyer should do it. I'll write one up, send it over to the guild's workshop, and you'll have 500 copies by noon tomorrow. The press is broken again, but the apprentices can copy it by hand. The practice will do them good."
"Thanks," Nora said cautiously.
But how much would that cost?
Oh, about 150 gunners, the wordsmith replied airily. But well worth the price.
Perhaps, Nora said agreeably, conscious of the fact that she had only 100 gunners in her purse. However, I'm looking for something a bit more economical.
The bright red money lust that surrounded the scribe flickered and started to fade.
Yes, well, I suppose we could use graffiti instead. For 75 gunners, our specialists could paint one-line messages into 250 highly visible walls throughout the city.
Nora looked surprised.
You mean people pay for that stuff?
Of course, the wordsmith said matter-of-factly. We run into freelancers from time to time, or lose messages when a citizen slaps a fresh coat of paint over our work. But it doesn't take long for them to see the error of their ways, especially after a couple of heavies drop by to say hello.
Okay, Nora agreed reluctantly. 250 locations sounds good, but how many words to a line?
10, the scribe replied succinctly.
I need more, Nora insisted as she counted them in her head.
17, to be precise.
That's going to cost you 5 gunners, the clerk warned primly.
Not necessarily, the sensitive countered as she leaned forward.
Remember that apology? What if your superiors were aware of what you've been up to?
The clerk's supervisor happened to be a woman, and he could imagine what would happen if she knew that he had undressed her hundreds of times. There were worse assignments than the market. Much worse. And he had no desire to receive one. Ink-stained fingers reached for a hand-sharpened quill, which the scribe dipped into a disreputable-looking bottle and held poised above a blank sheet of paper.
Okay, 17. What are they?
Nora looked off into space as she recited them.
Come see the famous sensitive Lanny Nor communicate with the dead Friday at 8 in the Actors Guild.
That's 18 words.
Okay, Nora said nonchalantly. Make it 18, then.
The scribe's pen made a scritching sound as he transferred the words to a piece of tan parchment. The sensitive noted that each letter was formed with the perfection of an ancient printing machine, and marveled at how precise the man was. It was evident that he enjoyed his work, because as he wrote, the color of his aura changed from red to a harmonious blue.
That will be 75 gunners, the wordsmith said as he blotted the paper. Payable in advance.
I'll give you 40 up front, and the rest when the messages actually appear, Nor replied. The scribe swore under his breath.
All right, but a heavy will show up Friday to collect, so you'd better be ready to pay.
I will be, Nor replied confidently, and counted gunners out onto the surface of the counter. By the way, this will be a demonstration of psychic phenomena rather than some sort of show.
I think you should come.
Thank you, the wordsmith answered politely, but I'm busy that night.
Okay,
Nora said as she prepared to leave.
But your wife is there by your side. She says that her death wasn't the least bit painful. She's happy on the spirit plane.
And you should stop grieving for her.
No one knew about the true extent to which the scribe missed his wife, and he hadn't mentioned her death to the young woman. So how did she know?
Tears welled up in the clerk's eyes, and he used a tattered sleeve to wipe them away. He opened his mouth to speak, to ask Nora what his wife looked like now. But the sensitive was gone. Because the monastery had been built hundreds of years before, back when Saros was little more than a settlement, it occupied a piece of prime real estate atop one of the hills marking the city's eastern boundary. The complex was surrounded by high walls, which the Brotherhood said had been built to keep ignorance at bay, but had practical value as well, for hardly a month passed without an attempt to break in and steal the gold that was rumored to be kept there. There wasn't any gold, of course. But the monastery did contain some precious artifacts, which was one of the reasons why the Dibois, iron men, patrolled the walls. The other reason, the person each of the warriors was sworn to protect with his life, threw a door open and bounded onto the surface of a large flat roof.
The guards smiled indulgently as the 10-year-old boy ran in circles, waved his arms, and sent a flock of white wings flapping into the air. It was a daily ritual, and one of the few unstructured moments in the youngster's day.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?